When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today Trita Parsley and Asla Bali. Trita is the Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and the Director of the Better Order Project, which we're talking about today. Asla is a Professor of Law at Yale Law School and also a non-resident fellow at Quincy, like myself. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So I think the first question is just, what is the Better Order Project? What is the goal of it? And what are the findings of it? And then we could get into talking about the details. But for people who have never heard of this, and if you're interested, you could go to betterorderproject.org, and there's a nice summary and full, you know, disclosure. I signed the report. So before we get into that, though, what is it? Where did it come about? What are its major findings?
Thanks so much, Derek and Daniel, for having us and getting us an opportunity to talk about these issues. So about a year and a half ago at the Quincy Institute, we started this project. And essentially what it was a realization that the path that the Biden administration was going down, all of this talk about the rules-based international order, we had seen how that term had become really weaponized by the Biden administration to become really nothing less than an effort to extend American primacy. And we saw, particularly after about a year into his presidency, that he really went back to that type of a thinking, despite his earlier promises of reducing America's military footprint in various places. So we brought together about 130 people from 40 countries to start thinking through, as the world actually does transition towards multipolarity, what are the type of reforms, particularly in the security area and in the security architecture of the world, that is needed in order to make sure that it is possible, but also that it is stable? And this is because almost all of the thinking in Washington, when it came to the issues of order, still seemed to presume that the United States would remain a unipolar power. It was almost heretic to even suggest, let's talk about in detail how we should adjust to, how we should handle multipolarity. So we brought these people together, and we deliberately wanted to get a lot of people from a lot of other countries, particularly Global South, in order to make sure that it actually was representative of how the world looks today.
Very quick question, and this is probably for Asla. Asla, would you mind explaining what is an order? What is an international order for people who might not be aware?
Yeah. I mean, one of the challenges with the rules-based international order language is it piggybacks on language that many would otherwise deem desirable in the international system. It displaced the international legal order. And what the international legal order was about is structuring relations between states in a way that was relatively predictable and stable in the aftermath of two catastrophic world wars and the real possibility that the advent of nuclear weapons meant future great power conflict could result in a planetary extinction phenomenon. And so in order to offset that against that risk and structure relations in ways that could produce predictable, stable, at least trajectories to avoid nuclear conflict and other kinds of massively destructive conflict, specific and universally sort of designed international legal rules were established with the participation of all states in the international system. And the so-called international legal order, to be distinguished from a rules-based international order, the international legal order was an order that was actually built on a set of laws that commanded the consent of all the states in the system. They agreed to these rules as the way to order relations between themselves. The distinction between that international law-based system and a system that is based on rules that are a la carte and are selectively enforced and are decided by a subset of states led by the United States is that one constrains all actors and thereby generates the kind of stability and predictability that could be called order. And the other one simply presumes the capacity of the rulemaker to dominate all other actors. Well, if the rulemaker is in a position to dominate all other actors, you can see why that's attractive, for example, to the United States. But as Shita was pointing out, as we move into a multipolar system, that's actually a recipe for conflict and disorder, because actually the United States may not have the power to impose its rules preferences, for example, on actors like China, may not be able to constrain Russia by invoking a set of rules that are only applied in selective manner and that are themselves the subject of double standards and definitely not constraining the United States.
If I could just add one thing to what Ashley said that I think is so important. It is, on the face of it, such an attractive word, you know, because rules, right? I mean, who could possibly be against it? And it's really shocking to us to see how many officials from governments, particularly in the West, have not understood the distinction between a law-centered and a rule-centered order. And they actually think that the rules-based international order is synonymous with the international law-centered order. One of the dangers, in addition to what Asla was pointing out, is that thus far, Russia and China have still justified their actions within the existing legal order. But there's a risk that if the Biden administration had continued, or if these ideas about a rule system that we essentially ruled entirely, if they get picked up again, that Russia and China will then also start replicating that and pursue their own rules-based order. And then we would end up in not just a multipolar world, but in a multi-order world, which is much worse than what we had during the Cold War, in which, despite all of the differences that existed, there was nevertheless an acceptance of a super order with international law, the UN system, etc. There was differences on the interpretation of law, but there weren't different competing systems of law necessarily in place. And that actually will make this era much more unstable than even the Cold War era was.
So that was going to be my question, actually, to talk about what a multi-order world might look like, because I think, you know, this is an alien concept for probably anybody listening to this show. But what, you know, when you're talking about the, you know, trying to avert the possibility of a multi-order world, just give people some sense of what that might look like.
Well, one thing that it would look like is not having either a shared understanding of how to frame the, you know, conflicts that basically are transnational in their character. So whether it's international security, so war, or climate, or monetary disorder, or any number of things, the problems that the UN architecture sought to solve for at the end of the Second World War was creating a single architecture that all states could come together in order to discuss and try in some manner to solve transnational problems before they engendered planetary risk. If you had a multi-order system in which each great power had a kind of sphere of influence and set the rules within that sphere of influence for the terms on which states that belong to that sphere of influence interact with one another, there would be no rules for how each of those separate orders interact amongst themselves. The distinction with the Cold War, for example, is that exactly as Chita said, the international legal order was a super order. The U.S. had its sphere of influence, the Soviet Union had its sphere of influence, and they had intense relations with states that were within those spheres. But they also had a shared structure in which, and a shared structure that encompassed an asymmetry within it, an architecture that was designed to acknowledge their asymmetric power in the order by giving them veto power on the Security Council and so forth, in order to keep them in the system. What we now risk with the U.S.-designed rule-based international order is incentivizing China, Russia, and others to not only develop their own rules and their own organizational structures for their spheres of influence, but to defect altogether from the shared order, leaving no shared playbook for how to manage conflict between them.
And one thing I think we should keep in mind is that, as one of our participants, the former National Security Advisor of India, Shiv Shankar Menon, points out, historically, multi-order reality has actually been the norm rather than a uni-order. But that was also during periods in which those major empires were quite distant from each other, and there was, you know, gray zones in between. We are now in a world in which everyone is in everyone else's so-called sphere of influence, and to have a multi-order competing sets of laws within that is just a recipe for disaster. And it's not entirely clear to me whether the Biden administration actually was driving things in that direction deliberately. But when you read their NSS from 2022, it actually sounds as if they were, because they're describing the rules-based international order not as a governing structure, but as a block. They talk about countries that subscribe to the rules-based international order would also get protection from the United States militarily. I mean, it sounds like a NATO plus, a NATO.
Yeah, and they say NATO goes to Asia in that. They're like, NATO will go to Asia.
Exactly. So,
and impose order.
It's almost as if it's a desperate effort to try to retain a modicum of unipolarity by bringing together as many of these like-minded countries as possible, give to them the benefit the United States had had itself throughout the decades, which is the U.S. could oftentimes put itself above the rules, above the laws. But I think what we saw under the Biden administration, that increasingly it was allowing its allies to also do so as part of the benefit of being a subscriber to the rules-based order.
I guess this is an awkward time to announce that Jake Sullivan is going to be joining our show as the third mic, but we'll continue here anyway. So maybe
also
we could say
Anthony Blinken's writing our new theme music.
We hired him to write a song. He's not ready for the mic yet.
Musical director. Yeah.
We're pivoting hard to the blues. It might make sense now to talk about what are some of the major findings or what are some of the major conclusions that this esteemed group of people came up with.
So we identified 7 variables that we would focus on exclusively in the security realm, because we didn't have the bandwidth, the budget to be able to go beyond that. This was a huge task in and of itself. And that ranges from climate, peace and security, non-proliferation, UN Security Council reform, norms around the use of force, AI, obviously. Asla, help me out. I think I'm missing one or two.
Rules
economic
around
sanctions.
Economic sanctions, yeah.
Economic sanctions, as well as ordering in specific regions. So we looked at Europe after Ukraine. We looked at Middle East after Gaza as well. And I think the first thing to remember is, as much as there are major problems and challenges and flaws with the existing law-based order, it was just absolutely clear to everyone, there is no chance in hell that one can start from scratch and build something better. We have to build on what exists and use the best of it and try to improve on it. And even the opportunity to improve on it is shaky. We may end up having to be in a position of trying to defend as much of the good that there is and try to prevent further hollowing out of specific norms, particularly on the use of force. That's where we see things going really in the wrong direction. But the reinvestment in the system and realizing that the answer at the end of the day is to really go back to a law-centered order, do away with whatever fantasies about rules and coalition of the willing type of systems, was very clear by all participants. And then we have, you know, very specific proposals. I can tell you that the one on UN Security Council reform is starting to get a lot of interesting traction, because there is momentum for it right now, because of the Pact of the Future, and also, frankly, because the Security Council is deadlocked as a result of the great powers being at odds with each other. If everything was fine and dandy between the US, Russia, and China, there would be almost no opening for Security Council reform. But precisely because they're deadlocked, there actually is an opportunity. And then you have the rise of the rest with the Global South that increasingly cannot be ignored. So there is a momentum. Last time there was that was exactly 20 years ago in 2005. And I think that some of our ideas that we're putting together there may actually end up helping bringing about some of that change, whether it's in total or you know, elements of it.
I'm happy to jump in here just to add a couple of things. The first thing is just to understand, going back to what is order, to understand that the order that we have now and that we would be in the position of having to defend if we couldn't move in the direction of some of these reforms is basically freezing in place a post-World War II distribution of power. and reflecting the asymmetries of that moment. And of course, the distribution of power in the international system has shifted dramatically. So on the one hand, it has the benefit of the vision of the post-Second World War II generation of understanding the critical need for order and the real risks that have sort of receded in our own minds of what a nuclear war could actually mean, how catastrophic conflict amongst great powers actually looks like, the real risk of, you know, conflict on the mainland of one of these major powers or all of them. Those are not ideas, however much we might be able to speak about them in the abstract, that are real to us today in the way they were at the end of the Second World War. And so you have an order that is committed to by the most powerful states in the system that engage in a kind of enlightened self-restraint, if you want. That's the benefit. The problem is it is not aligned with the actual distribution of power in the world today. And it leaves in the hands of those states that were most powerful. And note that Shita mentioned the US, China, and Russia, but of course, Britain and France are also veto-wielding members of the Security Council, which makes no sense under the current configuration of Europe, particularly Britain, which no longer even acts as an EU representative on the council. And many rising powers, Africa and Latin America, are entirely excluded. Asia is represented exclusively by China. India is not present, and so on. So these are real problems, but shifting the structure, the asymmetric structure of the Security Council, remains in the hands of the permanent members, remains in the hands of these veto wielders at the moment. So not only do you have to come up with a great architectural design for how best to reflect today's distribution of power, you have to come up with a set of arguments about why those who currently have this kind of a monopoly would allow new entrants into the system. And I think the Better Order Project comes as close as any I've seen for providing those kinds of answers. And it also identifies the other weak links in the current international security order, one of which is the ability of states to redefine circumstances in which they can invoke logics of self-defense more and more broadly to justify what amounts to aggressive uses of force, which includes the deterioration of whatever arms control machinery we had, which includes the proliferation of and increasingly conflict over the use of extraterritorial sanctions unilaterally by one powerful state in the zones and spheres of influence of another, or even against one another. So these are all things that just wouldn't have necessarily been anticipated at the time that the existing international legal order was put in place that need to be addressed. But to address them, we have to have a set of arguments that appeal not just to the powerful, but that also gain buy-in from what are today middle power and rising states. So the acknowledgement of all of that is what drives this Better Order Project, and it provides a blueprint for how you could try to imagine getting there.
So maybe this is the place to ask the how question. Asli, you already started to kind of get into this, but my very cynical interpretation of all of this stuff, of going back to the concept of the rules-based order. I know, Trita, you said that people in the Biden administration treated the rules-based order as synonymous with the law-based order. But I find it, especially after the last, let's say, 16 months, to be much more cynical than that. It feels like the shift was a very deliberate way to get away from the concept of law and toward this concept of rules that don't really exist, aren't written down anywhere, so the United States can make them up as we go along, and that we can apply them to this country but not that country, and it becomes a completely subjective thing. So I guess my question is, to get to the how of this, is how do you address the United States and say, hey, let's neuter some of this, you know, a completely subjective level of power that you've decided to grant to yourselves as the arbiter of the rules-based order. Let's neuter that. Let's get back to a system and even go further than the system that we had in place before that, where your veto isn't necessarily absolute on the Security Council, where you've given up a lot of prerogatives here. What is the argument that you make? And then, you know, that could also be applied just as easily to China, could be applied just as easily to Russia. Like, what is the argument to get the permanent members of the Security Council, who would have to be the gatekeepers here, to go along with this?
I think the key here is to understand and truly internalize that we are moving towards, if not a multipolar system, nevertheless, a non-unipolar system. That's the key to all of this. If we were still in a unipolar world, let's say that 30, 40 years ago, from now, we would still be in that. I think then it would be a very tough task to convince a United States. But as we are moving towards a system in which we no longer are going to be enjoying the relative power as we did before, still going to be one of the most, if not the most powerful state, but not in the level of dominance, combined with the fact that you're now going to have a rise of not just peer competitors, but a good group of middle powers who are going to be modeling their behavior on the U.S.'s behavior and its desire and its inclination to set aside rules. Then you suddenly have an international system that is extremely unpredictable and quite unstable. And then the question is, if you no longer have the power to bind other countries to a certain pattern of behavior that you favored, then you need to look for alternative tools, perhaps combination of tools. And then suddenly the attractiveness of laws, of norms, of rules, real rules, not these fake rules, I think will be very different, because the United States will find itself in a very similar situation that almost every other country have in the last 50 years, in which they actually desire this because it is much more efficient to bind the behavior of other countries, particularly rival countries, through those laws and norms than it is to do so through military power or economic coercion. We're just not here yet. And what we did in this project is that we imagined that we were in the year 2040, that many of the current trends, you know, U.S. and China gravitating towards a conflict, UNSC reform not happening, would have continued apace, but without actually causing a collapse. But simultaneously, the world would have become undeniably non-unipolar, and countries would have not just intellectually recognized it, they would have internalized it and acted accordingly. And in that scenario, suddenly the U.S.'s interest is very different from what it is today. Today, we're the only country that uses financial extraterritorial sanctions on a massive scale. The minute the Chinese start using that as well, we will have an interest in creating some rules for the road on that tool, because it will be very painful for us as well. Right now, we were totally fine with the norms under the global war on terror. But guess what? Now Turkey and many other countries are using that exact justification to do what they're doing. And if you then suddenly have 20 middle powers doing that, we're going to have major problems. And U.S. power, U.S. military power alone is not going to be able to fix it. Then suddenly we're going to discover, contrary to much of America's tradition, that international law is actually in our interest.
One of the critical things in the sort of picture that Shuda just provided is that many of these arguments and strategies for reform are actually coincident with what would amount to U.S. self-interest in a right-thinking policy environment. Now, we're not in that environment. We haven't been in that environment in some time. But for example, if you're the largest economy in the world, then you benefit from a reasonably stable set of relations. And so you would think have an incentive to wish to see rules that preclude that kind of middle power-driven war or middle power-driven destabilization of regional arrangements that adhere to your benefit disproportionately compared to all other states in the international system. The United States has found itself isolated in General Assembly votes to a degree that is greater than any of its rivals in an international system that is of its own making, of which it is the author, and in which it is still the largest economy with the largest number of allies globally. How can that be the case? Well, the answer to that is that the United States has depreciated the capacity to exert soft power itself as a consequence precisely of its sort of selective application of rules, exemption of itself from the rules, all of which has encouraged a kind of destabilization that, taken to its logical continuation along the lines that Chita described to 2040, would produce a kind of destabilization that is going to harm the United States disproportionately, just as it is the beneficiary of stable order today disproportionately. So there's a logic of self-interest. The challenge is, can that logic be translated to policymakers that are thinking in extraordinarily short-term and transactional ways? And here I mean the Biden administration, not the Trump administration, although obviously that's equally true of the Trump administration, but the tendency to behave as if Trump is transactional, but previous administrations and previous governments in the United States have not been, is itself just a kind of, fallacy. And so if you take a close look at some of the reform suggestions that are in the better order. One example, the depreciation of the veto. Of course, the United States, you would think, in a complete, you know, in a vacuum would oppose that. But under these circumstances today, the United States is in a position on the Security Council where it can reliably expect at least two votes in favor of any position it takes where it matters from the U.S. perspective, and that is the votes of the French and the British. Neither Russia nor China have that kind of reliable expectation of a second vote in favor of their position. So first, this reform continues to benefit the United States. It's a reform that says only if you are singly casting a veto would you even face the possibility of some kind of a global override. And that override would, of course, require a two-thirds majority among states. Now, are there circumstances where we can imagine the United States facing that situation? Yes. Have we seen them recently? Yes, in the context of Israel-Palestine. But is the policy position that the Biden administration has taken systematically through the Security Council and elsewhere, is it ultimately in the self-interest of the United States? I think, again, there is a very clear argument that apart from the short-term interest in seeing Benjamin Netanyahu's government remain in office under the present configuration, which is in tension with medium and long-term interests of the United States, there is no argument that the United States would have been well served by a set of rules that would have required it to either gain the support of other Europeans that are on the Security Council or take a position that does not unite 95% of all other states against it, 99%. I mean, the United States often was standing together with Israel and a small number of Polynesian, Micronesian island states that it otherwise controls in the votes that were taken on the question of Israel-Palestine policy. Those were poor uses of U.S. power that did not advance self-interest. And you could have taken votes or taken positions in the U.N. that would have probably also better advanced the interests of Israel if there had been the possibility of striking compromises that would have drawn a larger number of states to support the U.S. position. But the U.S. didn't have to make those compromises. And ultimately, the structure that allowed the U.S. to just go forward in that unilateral manner was, I think, in the medium term, harmful to the very interest the U.S. was trying to advance.
So how does one go about addressing that issue of short-term thinking? Because there are multiple causes of it. The basic cause, of course, is politics. People are thinking mostly in terms of short-term goals. The thing that history shows is that a lot of decisions made about international affairs are made less because of international reasons and more are usually for parochial domestic political reasons. I think that explains a lot of U.S. foreign policy since 1945. I even wrote an academic article on this. But basically, I think we lost a lot of understanding by overemphasizing the international and transnational reasons for why U.S. foreign policy is the way that it is. Most things are actually quite local, quite national. There was a moment, of course, we all remember in the 90s and beyond when people were really into globalization and they said states don't matter. But I think the last several decades have demonstrated that that's just not empirically accurate. So basically, how do you address short-term political thinking, especially in a sclerotic political system like the one we have in the United States? And how do you address things like lobbying or capitalism? Obviously, these are gigantic issues, but I'm sure this has been thought of. So self-interest, I would agree, from a 50,000-foot view of humanity, correct. But maybe not the self-interest of someone like Donald Trump, who's going to be the one making a lot of these decisions, although admittedly not all of them. So how have you thought about that?
Well, I would just go back to one thing that Chita mentioned, which is all of this presumes internalizing the reality of multipolarity. That is that there are real risks and threats that the United States faces that it's not going to be able to resolve on its own, and that will come with very serious costs. We're not there at this moment. I think most American elites, never mind Eric Trump, simply don't understand that reality and are resistant to it and imagine acknowledging it to somehow itself be a method for entrenching that. Whereas they, to the extent that unipolarity is being eroded, their orientation is how can we shore it up and consolidate it? So what might focus the mind? I mean, one reason to think not in 2025 terms, but in 2040 terms, is that while the order may not have collapsed in 2040, it will certainly have deteriorated further in ways that may actually focus the mind, because that might reflect a set of threats, whether it's because climate becomes incredibly real or because
and the boomers
economy
will be
takes
dead.
A devastating blow.
And the boomers will be dead, right? Their lives are consonant with the empire and they'll be dead until they'll be actually open. And I think this is the thing you can't say. I don't think it's ageist. People die. But I think they're a gigantic block. I mean, obviously, right? Their lives are consonant with the empire. Sorry to interrupt, but they'll probably mostly be dead and that'll open up a lot of political
possibilities. Although they have been remarkably effective at reproducing their own way of thinking, as your earlier remarks on Jake Sullivan reflect. We have a young cadre, you know, I don't know, 40s and 50s policymakers and politicians that are simply, you know, born and raised and bred on Cold Warrior logic and just continue to operate, you know, sort of unthinkingly in that manner. So it really, I do think, is going to take an understanding, whatever might bring that about, of the magnitude of the threats that collapse of the order would produce for there to be another moment. I mean, this is the magic, if you want, of the post-World War II moment, is that real clarity of mind with which you had acts of enlightened self-interest that were about structuring an architecture that might entail some short-term cost, but would pay massive dividends in the United States. It had a generation of thinkers jointly with their allies that were capable of realizing a vision that has been as durable as any we've ever seen in terms of international ordering. But Shita, I know you've given some thought to where does political will come from, so let me turn it to you.
No, I'm in obviously in large agreement. I would just point out that if you just take a look at the last 25 years here in the United States, we've seen a dramatic change that has largely occurred because of the failures of Washington, but nevertheless, that shows how the sentiments of the population can change dramatically. I was in Washington in 2003 during the Iraq War. And I remember how dirty of a word peace was. Organizations did not use it in their names if they could avoid it. It was just not a particularly politically viable term to use. After the Iraq War debacle and everything else, we have probably one of the strongest anti-war sentiments in the United States right now. And Trump has been one of the few politicians who has even tried to channel that. I don't think he's the cause of it, but he's channeled it. And it tells you something of how out of touch Washington has been with the American people that so few others actually did. And I would say a huge negative on the Democrats, because in the last 4 years, they largely failed and they lost touch with their so-called roots, or at least having a bit of ground to stand on that realm, but they largely lost it. So we've seen that dramatic change. And I think a similar type of a dramatic change is going to be needed when it comes to the average American's attitude towards international institutions and international law. The starting point is, of course, extremely negative. And without going into too much detail, we are looking in the as part of the Better Water Project to see what type of a cultural product, whether it's a movie or a book or something else, can be done that can help move the conversation in the right direction. And you and I, Daniel, have talked a lot about Hollywood and its role in all of this. And it's necessary because its role has been used extensively in the opposite direction and has really helped ingrain the wrong type of ideas in the population. So I think that's one thing that I think we have to keep in mind, recognizing that these things are not constants. They do move. They move slowly. We have to figure out how they move and make sure that it happens. When it comes to the immediate term of the Trump administration, since you mentioned Eric Trump, I think there are arguments that can be made, which is that at the end of the day, for instance, if Trump actually wants to reduce the U.S.'s military presence in certain theaters, and I think he's serious about it, I'm not so sure he goes about it the way I think would be most effective, but nevertheless, I think he is serious about it, then he's going to have to think through, okay, what do we leave behind? And is there a value to make sure that there is some sort of architecture in place that we can off-burden some of these security burdens in order to avoid a scenario in which ensuing instability will suck the U.S. back into those theaters. So again, you have to play to their own self-interest and their own agenda that they have. You don't sell them the idea that now you have to fall in love with the U.N. You have to fall in love with your own agenda, and your own agenda actually requires some of these things, even though you may not have thought of it yet. So I think there are openings. They may not be great, but they have to be pursued because the absolute guarantee for failure is not trying.
When you need need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I think maybe this would be a good point to get into the reception that you've gotten so far to the report as it's been released. And what Danny and I really want to ask you guys about is the vibe in DC with the changing administration. But let's build up to that and start with what kind of reception you've gotten so far from the report.
So let me start off by saying this. We are right now in the early phases of the promotion of the report. We will have a panel at the Munich conference to talk both on the order side, but also on the UN Security Council reform. I will also speak on another panel at Munich on this. We're organizing events around the country and around the world. We've had plenty of meetings with government officials, and specific proposals are getting very strong traction. Perhaps a bit surprisingly, but the Middle East proposals actually are getting a lot of traction right now. And I think part of the reason for that is that, you know, political constellations, partly, of course, that you have this absolute disaster in the region. And I mean, we have to remember what we're seeing now is the bloodiest episode in Israel-Palestine since the creation of Israel. This goes well beyond the Nakba. And as a result, the failure to make sure that the political will that should be generated by such an absolute disaster, the failure to capture that and move things in the right direction, I think would be something I would not want to live with. So we're working very hard, and we actually have been a bit positively surprised at how well that has been received in key capitals. And without mentioning any names, certain very key players on the international stage right now are looking at their last 6 to 12 months of being able to build the foreign policy legacy. And because of that, they are precisely looking for the big ideas, not the politically viable ideas that they know ultimately will be failing. Yes, they will succeed in terms of being adopted, but they will ultimately fail, just like Oslo failed. They're looking now for the bold ideas that actually could work, even though politically they will be much, much tougher to get through. On the UNSC, that's another area in which we've got a tremendously positive reception, because the situation was deadlocked and there were competing proposals, and it was very difficult to kind of break some of the groupings that have been formed. Our proposals are essentially putting forward a win-win-win, something that is a win for the existing great powers, for middle powers, also for the smaller powers. Something that breaks the deadlock between the African states on the one hand and the G4, which is China, which is India and Brazil and some other states. So it's been helpful to be disruptive. And now we just have to work really hard to build a new coalition of states that can get this through. But I've never seen the type of optimism on this issue that I'm now seeing when talking to officials at the UN and elsewhere. There's a recognition that the moment has arrived. And new ideas are needed, and new ideas that are actually looking beyond just the expansion of the council, but is actually looking at other things such as the veto and the day-to-day practices of the council.
One of the things that is notable in that response is that it is not a beltway-centered response. There's a lot more interest in other capitals, obviously, and globally. And this is not something that is, you know, unimportant. I mean, it's important to be able to find ways to leverage and, you know, build on that interest globally. Because one of the things that has really become clear, particularly under the Biden administration, but was already the trend line from basically the Iraq war forward, is that there is a defection from a willingness to go along in the kind of post 9/11 environment with U.S. priority setting, because it's been so destabilizing globally. And so being able to articulate a vision that gets buy-in from other powers, powerful actors in the international system, is also an important building block. But when you do turn to the Beltway, it's worth noting that the place where the Biden administration will be remembered, I think most critically, is its foreign policy choices, everything from the method by which the Afghanistan withdrawal was undertaken, the execution of the Afghanistan withdrawal, to the absolutely catastrophic policies with respect to Israel-Palestine, but also choices that were made in Ukraine. I mean, a whole range of foreign policy mistakes that will be even clearer, I think, as time goes by than they are on the day that Biden left office, but they were already very clear. Against that backdrop, what is the incoming Trump administration's set of incentives? He wants to be understood as a peacemaker. Over and over again, he brings up the Nobel Peace Prize as something that is a desiderata from his perspective on his, you know, trophy board. And they want to be disassociated from the errors that the Biden administration has committed. They're clear on their rivalrous approach to China. They're clear on wanting to draw down the Ukraine war. But the biggest failure of Biden's administration has been Gaza. And so it does create an opportunity. Where that moves us is unclear, I think. But having an articulated vision for a regional security architecture in the Middle East and a path forward on Palestine is a big advantage of this proposal, because at least it offers one possible answer to the question, how do you break from the legacy that Biden has left behind in D.C.?
So I think I want to ask both of you about the communities that you're in, Trita, sort of the world of think tanks and also the world of elite law. How are both of your communities understanding Biden, and how are they approaching Trump?
I mean, I'm happy to start. I think elite law is the last place you should look for anything, I think, of significance in terms of outcomes. But
it does seem irrelevant. Why is that? I feel like lawyers were like actually quite influential, particularly academic lawyers at certain moments in the 20th century, particularly the New Deal to the Great Society, were actually quite influential. And now it just seems like maybe that's a story of academia, but kind of cordoned off. It's a little surprising.
Yeah. I mean, some of it is the partisan character of the academy. So they're going to have more influence in a Democratic administration, generally speaking, not across the board. There are plenty of very conservative law professors that are flocking to the Trump administration and peopling the bench that have nominees from judiciary to actual courts. And there are plenty more that are willing to carry water for the Trump administration in a variety of public ways. But as a category, it is nonetheless widely identified with Democrats, I think. So that's one part of it. But I think more generally, there is a real crisis in not just elite law, but in elite academia today. I think part of the culture war that Trump represents is a war on higher education, a war on traditional so-called elites. And unfortunately, from my perspective, the response to that is, instead of a forthright defense of either the vocation of higher education or the mission of the university or the project of higher education in the United States and its role, even in the sort of primacy world, instead, it's an absolute retreat. It's capitulation in advance. It's an attempt to appease the powers that are driving this culture war and get out of the way and get out of the crosshairs. And the consequence of that is a kind of troubling silence, with the exception of, you know, the odd eccentric, let's say one is speaking at this moment, but the odd person that's willing to take the risk of having strong views and expressing them and having them be informed by research and scholarship. Instead, what you find for the most part is an unwillingness to take risks and a desire to keep the head low and hope the moment passes and then look for the next opportunity to get an elite appointment when an administration that's more sort of amenable to the politics of American elites is in office. Traditional elites, again, higher education style.
So the liberal elite nonsense is just strong as powerful at Yale Law School, even with the various failures of liberalism over the past 50 years.
I mean, I think Yale Law
so
School.
So grim.
All
Jesus
school.
Christ. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the elite law schools. Yeah.
These are places for the formation of a particular kind of an elite that understands its cultural power in terms that are about proximity to those who hold power.
Like J.D. Vance,
proud
YLS graduate.
Stuart Rhodes. I mean, there are a lot of proud YLS graduates to count in the sort of ambit of the Trump administration. But most of those who are actually employed in academia today are, you know, risk-averse individuals that want eventually to be able to return to the halls of power and are prepared to remain silent in a moment like this one. And I think it's, I mean, and again, I don't mean this for any particular law school or even law schools in general. I mean this for all of elite academia in the United States. And it's a huge failing, particularly in moments of real crisis, for that kind of personal ambition to swamp the actual underlying project that is supposed to be higher education. And there's been, I think, an enormous betrayal of that project and of the vocation of academic freedom and what universities are meant to stand for. And actually, it stands in contrast to the response that in other countries, academics and higher education have had in the face of autocratization, as an example, right? I mean, you see faculty stand up and take real risks, speak up and pay a price, admittedly, but do so out of a set of convictions that appear to be, for the most part, much, much weaker and much more easily giving way to personal ambition here in the United States.
And it's a real sociology question. I am very curious about how I always say, like, academia, especially elite academia, it's not the most exciting work is not coming from elite academia right now in my own field. It's just for the fact of the matter. And that's partially because the history as a profession has basically disappeared. It's not being reinvigorated with younger people who are more attuned to new things. But it's just, I was talking about it the other day, like, a lot of boring work, stuff that's not especially interesting. Derek, did you want to ask something?
No.
Then I'll go to Trita. Yeah, Trita, how is the think tank world?
Yeah, let Trita.
Yeah, what's the vibe of the think tank world these days?
So in some ways, it's a similar crisis as we had when Trump first was elected. People see what he's doing and find that to be completely contradicting their values and tradition. But at least back then, I think there was a clearer understanding that that crisis needed a new response. And that's part of the reason why you had Jake Sullivan work at the Carnegie Institute endowment, and they came up with their report, which I ultimately don't think really amounted to anything else but to pursue primacy under a different name. But this is where, you know, the foreign policy for the middle class, et cetera, came from, in which they did the study and they saw how out of sync Washington is with the American people on this issue. Now, I think we're somewhat of a similar situation in which there is a rejection of much of what he's doing and saying, but I'm not so sure whether there is the same effort quite yet to recognize there cannot be a return to what was before, because what was before gave birth to this. These are not independent things. And haven't seen that leadership yet, which I actually think is a great opportunity, because it is an opportunity to not just reject some of the lawlessness that we're seeing right now, but to reject also what the Biden administration's answer was, and really recognize, looking forward long-term, and recognize the need for the United States to adjust its policies and its attitudes towards some of these things, because we are entering a new world in which American power cannot give answer to all of these different things. And as a result, we will need these additional instruments. I think the opportunity is there. I can't claim that we're seeing movement in the right. It's just too soon to tell. But I think over the course of the next year or 2 years, we should be seeing something on this front. But that requires real long-term thinking and leadership. And that, I don't think, is going to come from Washington. It's going to come from outside Washington, and then it has to be channeled by some entities in Washington.
Maybe for a final question, and to both of you, I'll ask the same question, but I'm curious as to your answers. How is on one hand the international law elite community, and on the other hand, the think tank community responding to U.S. actions in Gaza? I mean, such a monstrous world historical crime that in some sense gives the lie to international law as a project. You know, and I mean, I think the criticism of international law goes back long and blah, blah, blah. This is pretty bad for it as a project. And Trita, also the fact that basically a lot of the DC establishment lined up behind this brutal policy of annihilation. How are people dealing with it, or are they not dealing with it? So maybe, Asa, we could start with you, and then we could go to Trita.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's striking in the United States, and this is where all the hand-wringing about Trump really falls down, is the amount of fundamental elite consensus around U.S. foreign policy, including Gaza. I mean, what happened under Biden was, as you rightly said, just astonishing, appalling. The underwriting financially and militarily of a brutal onslaught on a basically unarmed civilian population trapped in a very small 25-mile enclave. It's just an astonishing moment. It's in violation of every kind of international law one can imagine. It has been found so in the preliminary provisional measures from the International Court of Justice. There are arrest warrants out from the International Criminal Court. There's an advisory opinion on the illegality of the occupation as such, et cetera. And yet we're in a moment where U.S. policy stands lockstep with the Israelis. But, you know, nothing would have been different under Trump. There's very little reason to expect that Trump would have restrained. And today it looks like there's just going to be a doubling down on that set of policies. And so against that backdrop, then, how do international law elites respond? And given what I just said a moment ago, primarily through polite silence. There is an enormous anxiety around naming the things that we're seeing. Like, for example, the debates are all about, should we or should we not use the word genocide? And there are just kind of rarefied doctrinal questions that are raised, et cetera, but an unwillingness to forthrightly name the thing that we're seeing, which is just the shredding of international law, regardless. I mean, first of all, I think there's no debate about the genocide question. But even if you wanted to debate that, then the most, you know, ground you're going to stand on is we're talking about crimes against humanity or some other category. Either way, U.S. policies have not just enabled and allowed, but directly contributed to those kinds of international law violations. And what you don't find coming out of international law elites, whether in the academy or outside the academy, is denunciation of this. Instead, in fact, what you have is a denunciation of those who would want to make this the main topic of discussion and a polite looking away, essentially, from this as either, I don't know, whether we're supposed to accept it as realpolitik, if it's simply a matter of a perpetual primacy project that has certain kinds of costs. I mean, whatever the rationale is for the really incredible silence around all of this, notwithstanding the fact that it has produced some, I think, productive generative schisms, it has brought to the surface some realities about how international lawyers understand their project and how they understand the demands of the existing international legal architecture. The incredible silence, for the most part, and silencing and repression around, you know, open discussion of what's been happening in Gaza is really telling for international law circles. And what it speaks to is the fact that in the United States, and this is distinct from many other countries, international law is really the domain of State Department and Defense Department lawyers. Academics that are successful in this domain are frequently in a revolving door in and out of those positions and internalize the position to such a point that even in their academic work, they're very often simply writing briefs in defense of positions that the United States has taken. And so in a circumstance where you have intense elite consensus around a policy that is clearly in violation of international law, it breeds silence. It breeds a silence that I think speaks, as I say, ill of the independence of international law scholars as a general group in the United States.
You asked if they're addressing it or ignoring it. I would say they're addressing it by ignoring it. This is the Iraq War of the Democrats. They failed just as the Republicans did. They all lined up more or less behind this, and the efforts by a handful of few within the party to speak up against it was dramatically shut down, as we saw.
I mean, for me, it discredits like AOC. It's like supporting the Vietnam War. To say that she was working tirelessly, that Biden was working tirelessly for a ceasefire, I can't support someone who does that. That is
I think it's a lot of policy. It's really depressing lines within the party, I would say. And I think we should note, though, however, that there appears to be a degree of implicit recognition, which is obviously not enough. But we did note that the Biden administration more or less stopped using the term rules-based international order after Gaza. I think we identified in the first 6-7 months after Gaza that the senior officials only used it in about 12 occasions, all of them in the context of Ukraine. But even there was a massive decline because it was a recognition that the degree of double standards and deceit was just, you know, beyond anyone's tolerance in the world. And they realized that this whole project had come crashing down as a result of their Gaza policy. And it also meant that they chose their Gaza policy instead of actually trying to abide by what they themselves had put forward as the metric, which was the rules-based order. They happily sacrificed that in order to be able to pursue this genocide in Gaza. So I think the moral collapse is just profound. And again, it does give us an opportunity with the right voices, the right political courage to be able to build something new out of that. Something new that is more constructive, doesn't necessarily follow the pattern that happened on the Republican Party, which nothing new was built until a major destroyer entered the scene named Donald Trump. And had to essentially remake the entire party in his own image to be able to move the Republicans to this point. Hopefully, Democrats will be able to perform much better, but they have much to answer for. And it's not just, in my view, Gaza. It's also their abandonment of diplomacy on Ukraine. It's one thing to support 100%. Ukraine, yep. But to shut down the voices within the party that were trying to at least make sure that there was a diplomatic avenue as well, that there was an active search for an exit from the war rather than just war till victory. That was also a massive failure that I think made the Gaza policy almost logically consistent with their lack of moral standing.
Yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say that they didn't want, I mean, they actively didn't want peace. You just look at what they said. They just wanted Russia bogged down now and forever. I mean, particularly right after it began, like Blinken and Austin are just saying this. It's like, this is a gift. Just bog Russia down forever. And we'll never be able to forgive ourselves if we don't do that. They actively didn't want peace. And that's what always annoyed me about people on my side, you know, the left that supported it. It's just so obvious about what the empire was going to do. But there's a lot more to say there, as there always is, but I think we should leave it. And Trita, thank you so much for joining us. Again, everyone check out this betterorderproject.org. Check out the website if you're intellectually interested on where we're going. I think these types of visions, these middle range visions, are actually really crucial. And it's something that there really hasn't been a part of U.S. foreign policy for a long time. So if you're interested in this question of ordering, if you're interested in international relations, definitely check it out. Again, that's betterorderproject.org. And we look forward to having you both back again soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Danny.
Thank you so much for having us.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.